Okay, so nucleophilic and beta substitution and beta elimination are the subject of chapter 7. We actually already talked about these reactions in lecture 16 near the beginning last semester. Remember these make and break reactions, of course, which could be the acid-base reaction that we just talked about some of the lore of last lecture, and then SN2 substitution, which is the subject of this lecture. And as we went over their theory, but now we're into a little bit more of the lore. And we saw that there was also a similarity to the reaction called E2 elimination. That's the beta elimination here. So we've looked at these from a theoretical point of view before, and now we're going to look at a little bit more of the lore of it. Okay, so there are lots of reactions. Many of them have people's names associated with them who develop the reagents and the conditions for carrying on efficient transformation. For example, Alexander William Williamson in Britain in 1852 discovered this way to make ethers efficiently. And Finkelstein in the Netherlands in 1910 developed this reaction of sodium iodide with an alkyl chloride to make an alkyl iodide and sodium chloride. The trick involved was to use acetone as a solvent for this reaction, because it turns out that sodium iodide is soluble in acetone, but sodium chloride isn't. So the precipitation of the sodium chloride drives the reaction to completion. Now, so there's so these people get their names associated with them, Williamson ether synthesis, Finkelstein reaction. But in fact, sometimes these things can be generalized. For example, the Finkelstein reaction also works with an alkyl bromide, because sodium bromide precipitates as well. So the idea of generalizing reactions so you don't have to remember every one independently is a very important one. And in fact, you could do more generalization here, because those two reactions are both examples of exchanging ions, of a sort of double decomposition reaction, as we spoke about last semester. So as you begin to generalize, you don't have to remember as many of the details, but if you really want to carry out the transformation, it's important to look at the details and see exactly what solvent you use and temperature and so on to get a good yield. Okay. Now, the Menshutkin reaction discovered in Russia in 1890 is between an amine and an alkyl iodide to make a tetraalkyl ammonium salt. Right? And that's, in a way, quite different from the reactions above, the Menshutkin reaction is, because it creates ions, which the previous ones don't. Okay, or the Meerwein reagent, which was developed in Germany in the 1940s after the war, which reacts trimethyl oxonium fluoroborate, this funny salt with three alkyl groups on an oxygen and therefore positively charged. So that reacts with an alkoxide to give a methyl ether. It's a very powerful methylating agent. And that reaction is different from the ones above because it in fact destroys ions. Right? Or you could have a reaction called solvolysis, where an alkyl bromide reacts with solvent, ethanol in this case, to give an ether. And that solvolysis means breaking apart, that's the lysis part, by a solvent. So you can have a big, big catalog of all these reactions that you have to remember. And again, when it comes to lab and actually having to carry them out, it's very useful to know details of them and exactly what conditions you use. But generalization is what's makes things seem comprehensible, that all these are in fact the same reaction. They're all nucleophilic substitution reactions. Every one of the reactions has something with a high HOMO to begin with: alkoxide, iodide, nitrogen with an unshared pair, alkoxide, oxygen with an unshared pair, and they all have some low LUMO that it can interact with, a sigma star in all of these cases. So in a sense, if you look at it from the HOMO-LUMO point of view, they're really all the same reaction. But again, it's handy to know the details if you're going to be a practical chemist. Okay, so let's look at the generality of nucleophilic substitution to see if we can make some sense of how different reagents will react, so something about the specific. Okay, here actually, to generalize a little further, here's a reaction that's important in biochemistry. This base has a lot of high HOMOs on the nitrogens. It's called adenine, right? And here's the sugar, ribose. So these things can react with one another. You see, you have a high HOMO on the nitrogen and a sigma star LUMO of the ROH. So you could imagine these interacting with one another by the nucleophilic substitution reaction to substitute the N with two R's on it for the OH and make this bond. And this thing is called, since it's ribose and adenine, it's adenosine. The os means it's got a sugar in it, so there's adenosine. Now, you can do another nucleophilic substitution reaction. This is the amino acid methionine, right? So it has a high HOMO on the sulfur and ROH with a sigma star, so you can do a reaction there. Substitute SR2 for OH, and you've got S-adenosyl methionine. And this is something you can buy in health food stores and so on, S-A-M-E, the S-adenosyl, M-E is methionine. Okay, now, and that's an important reaction in biological transformation. So, for example, if you have something else that has a high HOMO on it, like arginine has a nitrogen with an unshared pair. Okay, so you could imagine, and here you have a low LUMO in the carbon that has the S plus attached to it. So you could substitute NHR2 for SR2, like that. Okay, so here's a third nucleophilic substitution that takes place, and then there's a fourth nucleophilic substitution because a base can come along and take the proton away, putting the electrons from the bond onto nitrogen. And then you get a methylated amino acid. In fact, this is not usually used to methylate amino acids per se, but the amino acids can be in a long chain in a peptide, right? So you can change a peptide after it's already been made into one that has different properties because the nitrogen has methyl group on it. So this is the mechanism of, or one of the most important mechanisms of biological methylation, which is used to after the protein has already been made, to modify it for some particular purpose. So all these nucleophilic substitution reactions are ubiquitous and very, very important for life. I know about this. I don't know much about this, but such about it as I know is because my daughter, who took this course, now studies methylation by S-adenosyl methionine. She's a biology professor at Bowdoin. So it's not only my son who teaches me things. Okay, so let's look at the generality of nucleophilic substitution by looking at the various elements that are involved in it. There's a nucleophile, there's a substrate, right? There's a leaving group, the L that was attached to the substrate leaves. And then there's some solvent that it takes place in. And you can vary any of these, the nucleophile, the substrate, the solvent, the leaving group. And not only do you learn in doing this variation how you should carry out a certain reaction in lab, but by studying it, you can learn something about this dependence. You can learn something about the nature of the reaction, and that's what we're going to focus on. Okay, and of course you have a product. But the interesting thing is that in that set of four nucleophilic substitutions involved in the biological methylation, the mechanisms are not all the same, right? So the first type we're going to talk about is SN2 nucleophilic substitution. And we're talking about it in some detail in order to demonstrate the logic of what it means to prove a mechanism using both experiment and theory. and it's pragmatic. It's not logic in the sense of taking a logic course in philosophy or doing mathematics. There's a practical element to it that's rather different. And you do it mostly by disproving all the alternate mechanisms. This is the Sherlock Holmes approach. Remember, Sherlock Holmes said, it's an old maxim of mine, that when you've excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So you don't prove a mechanism, you disprove all the other possibilities, and then you're left with the one that must be the truth. Now, this isn't strict logic, because in order to disprove all the others, you have to be able to imagine all the others and disprove them. Now, it's a little bit presumptuous to think you can imagine all possible mechanisms. I mean, the wildest mechanism is probably to have all the molecules come apart into atoms and they move around and rearrange into the products. But that's, we know, could never happen because the energy that would be required would be too high. Okay, so this logic requires that you disprove all the alternate mechanisms. So that means you have to somehow classify all these other mechanisms and try to disprove them group by group. So one, the things that you have to accomplish in the reaction are to break the old bond, the RL. You have to make the new bond. That's an association of things, right? So, and you can do these in various orders. You could first dissociate and then associate. So you could break the bond, then make the new bond. And that's a wild example. That is the one I cited, where you break all bonds and then make all new ones. But it's obviously going to be much more efficient to just break one and make one. Or you can associate first, make a bond of the nucleophile to R, and then break the bond to L. Or you could do the two things simultaneously, right? So among those three, you've got what seems to be all the possibilities. Okay, so let's look at these three possibilities. Do both at the same time: first associate and then dissociate. First dissociate, then associate, and look at what reaction coordinate diagrams we might imagine for them. So if it's concerted, you're going to make a new bond to carbon before you break the old one. So you're going to have a pentavalent carbon as a transition state. If you first associate, you're making one as you break the other, right? So that's a transition state. Or you could have an intermediate where you make the new one, get a compound, then break the old one. Or you can do the opposite. You can break the old one, have a trivalent carbon intermediate, and then make the new one. So the reaction coordinate diagram in the first case is going to be a single step where you're making one and breaking the other. But in the other two cases, there are going to be intermediates involved, either pentavalent, a stable or metastable pentavalent carbon, or a metastable trivalent carbon. Now, as I've drawn it there, we've supposed that the first step is the one that's rate limiting. But it could be, if we're trying to be general, it could be the other way. It could be that the second step is rate limiting as well. Okay, so we have these five mechanisms, concerted, or AD, or DA, and in those cases where it's there are two steps involved, either of the steps could be the rate-limiting one. Now, can we do anything about disproving some of these? Well, there are different ways to disprove, and what we're interested is what is, as we'll find, all these things can occur if you have special circumstances, right? But what is it usually, okay? Now, if things are normal, then it's not so likely that you'd have this arrangement, okay? Because if the reaction overall is exothermic, that means that if you're in the intermediate, and if Hammond's postulate holds, which it might not, it should be easier, the transition state should be earlier and lower for the more exothermic reaction. It should be faster. So you'd expect the second one to be lower if it's going to a lower product. You're on the way to something more stable. So so from the point of view of the Hammond postulate, these are implausible. That doesn't mean they can't happen, but so this is not a very strong argument, but at least it would be a little bit surprising if that were the most likely way for it to happen. Okay. Now, there are other much better ways of disproving something just than to just say it's implausible. For example, suppose if that carbon atom had three different substituents, A, B, and C, on it, in addition to the ones that are coming and going, right? Then you see that if you could bring a nucleophile in the second step, and now you've got the product in each case, and they're all the same. But do you see how they might not all be the same? Or in what respect they might not all be the same? Will, do you have an idea? All these products look the same, right? So in this case, it came from L going away. In this case, from L going away. In this case, from the nucleophile flying in from the left. What other possibility is there? Ryan? Right. The nucleophile could have come in from the right. Now, what would the difference be in the product? Is it the same product? Yeah, Andrew? Pardon me? Right, they're enantiomers of one another. In fact, if it went through the reaction on the right, you'd expect to come in either from the right or the left, and you'd get racemic product if you had started with optically active starting material. So that would be a stereochemical proof. If you got only this stereochemistry, then it couldn't have been that mechanism that went through a planar achiral cation. Okay? So they're tools for testing, that is, for excluding mechanisms, and one of them is the one we just showed, which is stereochemistry, which is section 7.4b. There's a good example given in that section of using radioactive iodine as the nucleophile to displace normal iodine as the leaving group. It's a clever kinetic scheme, but it wasn't the first way to do it. I want to show you the way they proved it first. Okay, it was done in 1923 by Kenyon and Phillips in Britain, and it involved this alcohol. So it's got the carbon is chiral, it has OH, H, methyl, and benzyl as the substituent groups. And it turns out that it has an optical activity of plus 33 degrees. That's how much it rotates the light. Okay, so we want to do a nucleophilic substitution at this carbon and see whether we get a single enantiomer of the opposite configuration. Okay? Now, it turns out that OH is not easy to get rid of, right? You can't just bring a high HOMO in and have OH come out, because OH minus is a very unstable anion. It's a very high HOMO. It likes to bond to the carbon, okay? Okay, but what you can do is do another nucleophilic substitution in order to change that OH group to something else. And what you use is this sulfur that has a chlorine on it. And the unshared pair on the oxygen can attack the sulfur. Now, we're not going to go through proving the mechanism of that one, but I can tell you what the secret is. The mechanism of reaction at sulfur, at this kind of sulfur compound, is association followed by dissociation. Because the sulfur has a vacant valence level orbital, a d orbital with no electrons in it, which can therefore rather easily stabilize the electrons that are on the unshared pair on oxygen. So you can form an extra bond to sulfur, and then the chloride can leave, so it's, and the proton is lost also from O, so that you get H replaced by this so-called toluene sulfonyl group, this one here. Right? And now that that, if you break this bond and the electrons go there to make that oxygen anion, it's ever so much better as an anion than OH minus, because you have vacant orbitals on the sulfur that can help stabilize the unshared pair on oxygen O minus, and also you have a lot of electron withdrawal, the kind of inductive effect we talked about last time, that make this it's a little bit analogous to sulfuric acid, the sulfur with a bunch of oxygens on it than an O minus. So that's now something that's going to be good as a leaving group, where OH minus was not good as a leaving group. But notice that we didn't touch this carbon. Whatever configuration this carbon is here, it's got the same configuration there. Okay? Because we only broke this bond, not one involving carbon. Okay, now we do, and that has plus 31 degrees. And does that mean, does that, the fact that the original one was plus and this one is plus, does that mean that we didn't change the configuration at carbon? I mean, we have another reason for supposing we didn't change the configuration of carbon. We didn't touch any of its bonds. But would this have proved it? The fact that they were both positive in their rotation, that they had the same configuration. Yeah. What?
No.
Why not?
Because the reason for optical rotation is very complex.
Yeah, very obscure. We can't figure it out from that. That's what Professor Weiberg talked to us about last semester. So that doesn't prove anything, but we know that since no bonds were broken to carbon, it must be the same as it was before. Now we bring in acetate as an anion, and the purple HOMO here is going to attack the purple LUMO, sigma star CO here. Right? So like this. And now we will have formed this new bond. This oxygen came from the acetate. It wasn't that oxygen. Okay, so we formed a new bond. So here's nucleophilic substitution at saturated carbon. Okay? Now, that thing has a rotation of minus 7 degrees. Now we know that it happened with inversion of configuration, right? That it's opposite the starting material. Right or wrong? Is that a fair conclusion? This is minus, this was plus, therefore it must have turned inside out. Can we conclude that? Aviva, what do you think? Why not? Yeah, we don't know what rotation means, right? Okay, we know it didn't completely racemize, right? Then it would have had no rotation at all. Right, but we don't know whether it kept the same configuration of carbon or inverted. Right, it proves nothing. Okay, now we can bring in hydroxide, and it attacks pi star of the carbonyl, as we talked about a lot last semester. Right, so we get this intermediate. This is an association, but then it's followed by dissociation. Right. The dissociation unzips the thing again like that. So we get this anion. Right? And the other product, apart from the top right half of the molecule, is acetic acid. Right? You can see that that's what's left, HO, O double bond, and C methyl. So we got acetic acid. But now here, among these two products, we have a strong base and a pretty strong acid. So obviously they're going to react with one another and you get alcohol and acetate. Okay. Now, the rotation of that, is that the same as the starting material? Right? It has a rotation of minus 32. Now do we know anything? Right, because we're dealing with the same molecule. So the trick of all this was to have just one reaction where you do nucleophilic substitution at the interesting carbon, the chiral carbon, the stereogenic carbon. Just one reaction, but the product is the same as the starting material. And now you can use the rotation to know what happened. And what you see is that it's essentially all, within experimental error, it's all inversion. R became S. So this was a really neat experimental design that allowed proving that there was inversion of the configuration upon nucleophilic substitution. Now, with respect to the experimental design, it seems a little bit more complicated than it would have had to been. We could, how about just starting with hydroxide comes in. Here's the reaction that we're interested in, the purple one here. How about we just, instead of using acetate, we just used hydroxide to come in here and displace hydroxide. Would that have allowed us to know what was going on? Well, you wouldn't know product from starting material, right? They both have hydroxide. That's where the thing that's in the book is interesting, where they used radioactive iodine and normal iodine, right? So you can look at that one on your own from reading it in the book. But anyhow, that obviously wasn't practical. But why do all this nonsense, aside from the fact that that reaction doesn't work for OH minus displacing OH minus, right? But once you've made a good leaving group, why do this stuff with the acetate and come through here? Why not just use hydroxide in place of acetate here and have it do the substitution? And then this showed backside attack, okay? But why not avoid the acetate steps by just using hydroxide instead of doing it in two steps, first acetate and then hydroxide? The reason is that the reaction doesn't work if you do it that way, because that's not what hydroxide does. Hydroxide attacks that hydrogen, right? And it pulls that proton off and loses the same group to generate a double bond. So you've lost the chirality, plus you haven't done the reaction you wanted to study. So it was important to use a different nucleophile, a different base here, use acetate, which is inclined to attack the carbon rather than to attack the hydrogen. And we'll talk a little bit more later on when we get onto the beta elimination, which is what this thing is. When we get onto that, we'll talk a little more about the difference between hydroxide and acetate. But there was a lot that went into designing this scheme, and if you remember it, it teaches you a lot of lessons. Okay, now as we said, the trivalent intermediate could have been attacked from either face and would give erasmization, not inversion of the configuration. So that's out. We've disproved that, at least for this reaction. And if this reaction is typical, the one on the previous slide, then that's not the way it happens normally. Okay, so there's a way of using stereochemistry, and many, many people have studied stereochemistry of such reactions. Okay, a second tool for testing, that is, excluding mechanisms, is to study the rate law. Now, the rate law for a reaction like this one, sodium ethoxide plus ethyl bromide to give diethyl ether, is how you relate the rate, which is how much product you get in a given time, to the concentration of the starting materials, ethyl bromide and sodium ethylate. So let's look at how the rate changes as you change the sodium ethylate or sodium ethoxide concentration for a fixed concentration of ethyl bromide, say a large concentration, so it doesn't change appreciably. Okay, so you put different amounts of sodium, different concentrations of sodium ethoxide, and you measure how fast ethoxide goes away. Because notice at the beginning you have a strong base. At the end you don't have a significant base. So the way these reactions were done in the early days was by titration. You see how much base is left after a given amount of time, and that tells you how much reaction has occurred. So you measure the change in ethoxide as a function of time by doing a whole bunch of titrations, and you find that that rate can be expressed in a straight line there, which says that the rate is proportional to the concentration of ethoxide. As you increase ethoxide, you linearly increase the rate. Of course, it's also dependent on ethyl bromide. You could do separate experiments changing the concentration of ethyl bromide, holding ethoxide concentration, and you find that it's first order in ethyl bromide as well. So K2, a second order reaction, dependent on both of the reagents. Okay, that doesn't surprise you, but there is something surprising about this graph. You may not see it, but do you see what's surprising about it? Right. At zero here, unfortunately I forgot to label it, but at zero there's a rate. When you don't have any ethoxide, you still have a rate. How can this happen? Incidentally, I forgot I was going to say this, that it, had it been dissociation followed by association, the nucleophile, the ethoxide, the high HOMO, doesn't get into the act until after the rate-limiting step. So it couldn't have had anything to do with the rate. So again, we can X out that one on the basis of just the rate law. But if we come back to look at this again, and this is where Henry's comment comes in, you see that there's a rate when you don't have any ethoxide. Now, how can you possibly get the product if you don't have ethoxide? It's because the solvent is ethanol. It's first order, right? Dependent only on the concentration of ethyl bromide. It can't depend on ethoxide. Now, is it truly first order? Or is it just pseudo first order? Does it depend on the concentration of ethanol, which is being the solvent, is approximately constant? Well, is that plausible that that's happening? We could have, obviously, the HOMO here attack ethyl bromide to give the product. That's the second order reaction that we looked at. Or we could have just an unshared pair on the oxygen do the same trick, right, which would give this, and then that could lose a proton, so you'd have the same product. Is it plausible that you could get a rate for a lower HOMO here than the one that has a negative charge on it? Well, we have some idea of how good how high those HOMOs are from the pKa's, how well they hold on to a proton, right? So this, we can find the ratio of these rate constants that the K2 here is 20,000 times as big as K psi here, the pseudo first order rate constant, because we know the concentration of ethanol, and at a certain concentration of ethoxide, for example, if you get to this concentration of ethoxide, the rate of reaction with ethanol is the same as the rate of reaction with ethoxide. Right, so we know that concentration of ethoxide is equivalent to the concentration of pure ethanol. And from that we know that the second order rate constant is 20,000 times as fast as the pseudo constant. Yeah.
The rate's measured in dethoxide, DT, right? The anion.
Well, in the second case, remember I said you do it by titration. In the second case, what you do instead of consuming base, which goes away, is you generate acid, right? But you can again do the but generating acid is like consuming base, so you can do them both by titration. Okay, now is it reasonable that they have that difference, 20,000? Well, we can look at we can look at the analogy where they react with a proton, right? And their pKa's differ by what is it, 17 and a half, right? They differ by 17 and a half orders of magnitude, right? In how well they hold on to protons. So this is very, very, very much weaker than ethoxide at holding on to a proton. It's only 20,000 times, if this is true, as good. Ethoxide is 10 to the 17 and a half better at holding on to a proton than ethanol is, right? But it's only 20,000 times better in this reaction, right? Is that plausible that they differ by so much there? Notice that measure is at equilibrium when the bond has been fully formed to the proton. Whereas here, you're interested in how much of the bond has been formed at the transition state. So much less of the bond has been formed. So it's not at all surprising that the effect is very much bigger here when you go from the thing to completely form the bond than it is in the reaction. where you only go from the starting material to the transition state with a little bit of formation of the bond. So it is indeed implausible that you could have this difference in those reactivity constants when you have this difference in the equilibrium constant. So the ratio should be much less drastic at the transition state for this so-called SN2 reaction. Now, SN2 means substitution, nucleophilic, all these ones we're talking about is a nucleophilic doing, and 2 means it's second order, right? Dependent in rate both on the nucleophile and on the compound being attacked. So that's the rate law. But in studying these rates, you get not only the rate law, but also the rate constant, right? So what's the K that's involved? Now, it can depend on all these different features, what the nucleophile is, what the substrate is, the R group, what the leaving group is, and what the solvent is. All those can make a difference. So you can systematically vary within any one of these categories and see how it affects the rate constant and what that tells you about the nature of the reaction. Let's first look at the substrate. So here the reaction is the alkyl bromide reacting with iodide in acetone solvent at 25 degrees, and this is the relative rate constant, assuming taking the ethyl bromide to be 1. How much faster or slower are these other cases? Okay, so if we do methyl, it's 145 times faster. But if we do ethyl, it's a small amount slower, right? If we do isopropyl, it's 100 times slower. If we do this isobutyl case, it's 30 times slower than the original one. T-butyl is so slow that you can't measure the rate. Now you might say just wait longer, but you can't wait longer because another reaction intervenes. So you can't study this one. All you can know is the upper limit. So it's very, very slow. Okay, something else happens. And neopentyl, something else doesn't happen, but it's really, really slow. It's 10,000 times slower than ethyl. Now, what can we learn about the nature of the transition state from this? Well, we can carbon that's part of the functional group here that has the bromine on it is often referred to as alpha, and the next carbon is often referred to as beta. So we can systematize among these different R groups by looking at making substitutions at the alpha position or making substitutions at the beta position. So, for example, if we started here, this one has made a substitution at the alpha position. It's put a methyl group on the alpha carbon. But here we've put 2 methyl groups on the alpha carbon, and here we've put 3 methyl groups on the alpha carbon. Okay? Or here we've put a methyl group on the beta carbon. Or here we've put 2 methyl groups on the beta carbon. Or here we've put 3 methyl groups on the beta carbon. And now we can try to see how do these successive substitutions affect the rate, rather than trying to look at everything all at once. Well, you see making a substitution on the alpha carbon slowed it down by 145 times, right? Putting a second one on slowed it down by another 128 times. So the second one had about the same effect as the first one, right? But the third one, so it's the same, it made the same difference in the activation energy, so the same factor in rates. Okay? But the next one is very slow. We don't know how slow. We know it's at least 15 times slower, but it's probably very much slower than that. Right? Now, let's try to understand that in the next slide, but look at the effect on the beta position. So here we've made one substitution in beta. It changes the rate by 1.2-fold. The second one changes it by a little more, 23. But the third one is drastic. It changes it 3,000 times. Right? Now, why? Well, there's the methyl bromide to be attacked, and we know that the nucleophile will come in and attack the backside of the of the sigma star bond. Okay, we don't know it, but this is what we're testing. So there's the LUMO, and that's where the overlap has to take place. And remember, there's between the red and the blue there is where the anti-bonding node is. That one will break as the new bond gets formed here. Now let's look at this at the on the van der Waals surface of what the potential is. How good is it to put a negative charge near there? Okay, well it's good here, plus 26 at this point on the surface, and it's bad obviously on the other end. So you expect it to come in from this side. Okay. So here are the different groups. We're going to attack the methyl or the ethyl or the isopropyl or the t-butyl. Right? There's the total electron density. Now what you notice is that to go from methyl to ethyl or isopropyl, and you don't see it so well here because it's the back of the picture, but each of these cuts away a little of the space you need for the nucleophile to get in. But this one is just drastic. When you put that third methyl group in here, this one that would have been, there's a hydrogen, here two hydrogens, here three hydrogens. When you put that third methyl group in, it gets very much weaker, so very much less ability to overlap. Okay, so that's called steric hindrance. That makes it very difficult to do impossible to do these SN2 reactions at the T-butyl group. Okay, we could also look at the LUMOs that are involved when we put methyl groups on. You see, they're all fundamentally the same group with this node here. That's going to break the old bond, but again, it's difficult to look at such complicated orbitals. You could look at it at a different contour and see that there's more to be overlapped with here than there is there, perhaps. Or if you look at the total electron density, it looks like that, and again, you can see that it's very hard to get at the LUMO. So in each case, this is the LUMO that I showed before, but superimposed on it is the van der Waals radius, and you see that it's very difficult. Here it's easy for the nucleophile to get overlap with the LUMO. Here it would run into the rest of the electron density before doing so. And if you look at the surface potential, you see it's much bluer in here where you're going to attack than it is here. So it's, again, harder to get the nucleophile in there. Now let's look at the corresponding thing with beta methylation. So we start with ethyl, which has no methyl groups on the beta carbon. Then we put in one or two or three methyl groups on the beta carbon. Okay, we need to attack that carbon. And now look at the electron density. The first methyl that you put on the beta carbon, or the second one, doesn't restrict the access very much. But when you put that third methyl group on, that you can't get to it at all. So the first and the second, that is this methyl group, and then this methyl group, can be rotated so they're out of the way. But the hydrogen that was here, when that one becomes a methyl group, it's impossible to get at it. So steric hindrance, again, in the case of beta methylation, is very drastic, slowing it down by four orders of magnitude, or five. So there's no way to avoid the third beta hydrogen. And again, you can see that you can't get close enough to get to the carbon-bromine bond to get low energy for an anion trying to get in there. Okay. Now the book in table 7.2 talks about cycloalkyl halides and their rate compared to the one that doesn't have a ring. So all these look maybe sort of the same, but they're not. This one is the same. Cyclopentyl bromide is about the same as isopropyl bromide, just very, very slightly faster. But look at cyclobutyl is slowed down by more than two orders of magnitude, and cyclopropyl is slowed down by two more orders of magnitude. Right, so these are really, really slow, these small ring ones. Now, why is that true? Well, what's special about small rings that we've seen before? Yeah.
There's strain energy.
their strain, right? Okay, because of the, we wanted to have a bond angle more or less like this, 109 or 112, whatever it is. And we have that in cyclopentyl. But in cyclobutyl and cyclopropyl, there's a great amount of strain. So that strain is going to make the starting material of this reaction high in energy, right? So if you raise the energy of the starting material, should you slow down the reaction drastically? What? It's the opposite. If you raise the starting material, other things being equal, you'd expect the reaction to get faster. So why is it backwards? Yeah.
Where we want to attack, is it...
Pardon me, I can't hear very well.
Where we want to attack, it's sort of inside the ring, so maybe if the ring is smaller, it's harder to get inside.
That's a good thought, and you'll see something soon that's very like that, but that's not this. Richard, did you have an idea? Okay, we're what determines the rate? We're raising the starting material, right? How about the product? When we've done a substitution, the product is going to come up. It still has a cyclopropyl group in it. So it's, we're not only raising the starting material, we're raising the product. What's really important in determining the rate? Brian?
The rate between the energy difference.
The energy difference between what? Ah, it's the transition state that we're interested in, not the product or the starting material alone. It's the difference between the starting material and the transition state. So it's true that the starting material is strained when you make a small ring. But the important thing is what happens to this, what this strain does to the transition state. Okay? So let's look at the transition state, assuming that it's where you have five things associated with the carbon. Right, it's not an intermediate, it's not stable, right? But you have both of these partially bonded at the same time these other three are. So these three in a plane involve sp squared hybridization. What does the bond angle want to be? The unstrained bond angle among those, say between the two carbons, among the three carbons here. 109.5 is for sp cubed. This is sp squared. Should be 120 in the product. But in fact, here it's 60, right? So the starting material is strained because it wants to be 109 and it's 60. But in the transition state, it wants to be 120 and it's 60. So there's much more strain in the transition state than there was in the starting material, right? So indeed, you expect the reaction to be slow because the strain is increasing as you go along the reaction coordinate. Okay. Now, notice that when we have cyclohexane, which has a normal bond angle here, right? It's slowed down by a factor of about 200 or 160, right? Yeah, let me just finish this. It won't take long. Why is that? Here's the transition state or something close to it for that one. And now you notice that this group, whether it's the one that's coming in and this one is going out, or whether the one going out and this one's coming in, either way, this group has been bent over, so it's very close to these two. Here it is, space filling, and you can see the crunch here and there. So if we look at cyclohexane, we can see, if we look just at the isopropyl group here, those three carbons, now attached to that in the ring are these two things that are very close to that, and that's something whose strain is going to increase in the transition state, so that's why it slows down there. So that cyclopropane is about the same as isopropyl, cyclopentane, but these others all acquire a special strain in the transition state. Okay, sorry, I talked a few minutes too long. That's the end.